Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us on this Medical Monday is Dr. David Hart. Dr. Hart is a board-certified neurologist at the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany, where he sees general neurology and memory patients with a focus on Alzheimer's and other dementias. He has practiced in Albany since the early 90s, both in private practice and academic settings. Over the last 25 years, he has overseen numerous clinical trials in Alzheimer's disease, including studies of several recently FDA-approved and pending treatments which slow progression of Alzheimer's. The number to call here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 if you want to call in, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. David Hart, Happy New Year. Welcome back.
Happy New Year, Ray. It's good to be back.
Great to have you here. Now, you mentioned just before we hit the air that there have been some results from some trials.
Yeah, so I was mentioning that the big clinical trials in Alzheimer's meeting, or CTAD, held at the end of the year. There are a couple of interesting things there. Not any medication that is about to break through and hit the market, but there are a couple of reports of antibodies targeting tau protein. The disease-modifying therapies that we have right now help clear amyloid out of the brain, mm-hmm. and that's one of the two hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease, amyloid plaque in the brain, Dr. Alzheimer described back in the early 1900s. And tau protein is the other. Tau protein changes occur much closer in time to when people develop symptoms, and they localize much better in the brain to where people develop symptoms. So the main presentation of Alzheimer's is memory loss. In those folks, they tend to have a buildup of abnormal tau in the memory centers of the brain and the medial temporal lobes. Some folks present with language disturbance, and their tau buildup initially is near the language centers of the brain and so forth. So tau is an interesting target. It probably doesn't have the risks of brain bleeding and brain swelling that intervention targeting amyloid has. So it's a tantalizing target. There were no big successes, but interesting that the tau antibody trials and some other tau approaches are moving along and I think are coming in a few years.
Now, how, without going into great detail that I will not understand, some listeners might, how do you actually remove the tau and the other alkaline, what do they call it?
Amyloid plaque.
How do you remove it? There's a blood-brain barrier, right? How do you get that stuff out?
That's really an excellent question. And the two medicines that we are using right now, donanemab and lecanemab, which are FDA-approved medicines that bind amyloid protein and help clear it from the brain, the way that they work is these are engineered antibodies that target and recognize the amyloid protein, and they bind to it. The fact that they have to cross the blood-brain barrier is a problem because only about 1% of the medicine of either one of these two that you administer makes it across the blood-brain barrier and into the brain. So you're giving 100 times more medicine than would be needed if it crossed freely into the brain. And that probably gives part of the accounts for part of the side effect issue that we have with these medications. And so if you can figure out ways of using lower doses, and that's something else that's coming. There are antibodies that are being tied to what are called shuttling proteins. And these are antibodies that bind to a protein that the brain actively transports across the blood-brain barrier. So you don't have to rely on there being a couple of leaky areas. Instead, you have some active, you know, it's like a bouncer guarding the door saying, all right, come on in, buddy.
So, okay, here we go. Too far into the weeds again. But I'm interested, how does the brain decide, okay, this one's just fine? Is it the size of the protein? How do you do that?
With the exception of a couple of privileged proteins that the brain finds necessary and actively transports in, that it grabs out of the bloodstream and pulls into the brain, other than that, it's largely size-related. Mm. And so proteins that are too big, medications that are too big, like these antibodies, cannot cross over into the brain unless there are some leaky areas. Now, you know, as we all recognize as we get older, and a couple of gray-haired guys at the microphones here today understand this well, that, you know, things fall apart a little bit as you get older. The blood-brain barrier is not quite as efficient, and so fortunately, some of these medicines do cross over. But I may have mentioned when I was here in September that one of the big amyloid advances that I think is coming is an amyloid antibody bound to a shuttling protein. And the phase two trial with that medication showed striking efficacy and a striking lack of side effects. So a big step forward from what we've got right now.
What are some of the side effects?
Well, the two side effects that we worry about the most with the amyloid agents are that they can cause areas of leaky blood vessels. They can cause bleeding in the brain as a result. And they can cause, targeting the amyloid can cause an inflammatory reaction in the brain, which is what we call vasogenic edema. Most often when these two things happen, there's no symptoms. We just pick it up on MRI, but they can cause symptoms, and in rare situations, they can cause serious consequences or death. So it's, you know, the more we can lower that risk of side effect, the better off our patients will be.
We're joined today by Dr. David Hart from the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany. We'll talk about dementia and Alzheimer's and other neurological things today. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Feel free to email voxpop@wamc.org. Regarding the trials, and you've done a lot of these trials over the last 30 years, you got amyloid, you got tau. And the way you described it to me is these tau proteins are often very closely related to the onset of symptoms, and they're also in the brain centers where some of these symptoms manifest, right?
Right.
Okay, so why not focus more on that and leave the amyloids off to the side?
I think because early on, amyloid was a more attractive target. Amyloid is extracellular. The neurofibrillary tangles that tau protein causes are intracellular. They're inside the neurons. Tau is a structural protein. It helps hold the cytoskeleton, the structural gridwork of the nerve cell together. And when it becomes too sticky, one piece of tau binds to another piece of tau, and they get together and they form these jumbles of protein, which look like twisted tangles, the neurofibrillary tangles. We know now that there is an extracellular component of tau, but that's only been over the last few years that that has been proven. So amyloid, which is extracellular, was an easier target. There's also the fact that the genetic syndromes that cause Alzheimer's disease, mutations in the presenilin 1, presenilin 2, and amyloid precursor protein genes, the genetic syndromes that cause Alzheimer's are all based on overproduction of amyloid. So it seemed a reasonable thing to try and attack that first. It also seems like amyloid problems start off first, and tau abnormalities occur down the road.
But closer to when symptoms occur.
Right.
We're joined by Dr. David Hart today. It's Alzheimer's and dementia. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll get to the calls in a minute. Before we hit the break, though, you don't have to answer this if you don't want to. So you mentioned the genetic component. What percentage of people who manifest full-blown Alzheimer's have that genetic component?
It's a great question. I think the answer is around a half of 1%.
Oh, that's not that much.
Right.
So my next question was going to be, philosophically, would you be on board with everyone getting that genetic marker test?
No.
Because
it only pertains to a very small fraction of the population.
Yeah.
And because even in those folks, we haven't had anything to do about it. Now we do have these two disease-modifying agents, and they're being trialed in inherited Alzheimer's patients, in early-onset Alzheimer's patients, to see if treating people before they develop symptoms can delay symptoms or mitigate the symptoms. And to this point, those studies have not been as positive as we would like, but we're not done with that yet.
Are you optimistic that such a thing will happen in your lifetime or mine?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Gosh, I love it. You don't look that optimistic in general, but all right. Dr. David Hart is our guest today. It's Medical Monday. We'll take a break here, and then we'll get to your calls. 800-348-2551. You know, the Northeast is unique. The people, the communities, even the weather. WAMC reflects that back to you every day with stories, news, conversations that matter to you. And as a nonprofit, WAMC can only provide that service with support from you. And we'll need strong support. The Fed is not there no more, folks. I'll tell you that. The lockbox is now open. With a donation today, you'll help fill it up, keep fundraising short. That's a good goal. You also keep the programming strong the way you want it, the way we want to do it for you. Has it ever been perfect? Well, if you've heard this show, you know it's not perfect, but we're working on it every day. Give now, make that pledge, fill the lockbox, WAMC.org. All right, now thus endeth the sermon. Now it's back to Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Dr. David Hart is with us. 800-348-2551. Let's grab an email and then we'll hit the phones. This is from Rick, and the subject heading is sense of smell and gum disease. What percentage of dementia patients show signs of these two biomarkers, and how exactly does the olfactory bulb play a role? What's the olfactory bulb?
The olfactory bulb is a part of the olfactory nerve. The olfactory nerve is the first cranial nerve, and this is the nerve that gives you your sense of smell. So these are nerves that originate in the medial temporal lobe. They originate on the inner aspect of the temporal lobe, kind of a couple of inches inward from the ear, and they extend along the floor of the front of the brain through, appropriately, the olfactory groove, and then they stick nerve endings down through a very thin part of the skull into the nasopharynx, where they can identify different aromas that you're exposed to. The origin of these nerves anatomically is very close to where the memory centers of the brain are, and it's been known for years that a loss of sense of smell is an early finding in several neurodegenerative disorders, including Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So some people have proposed that there ought to be routine smell testing of patients to screen for these things, and that has not really come to pass. It's You know, there are different ways of doing it, but finding a standardized way of doing it is one thing. Knowing what abnormality you're identifying, if it is abnormal, is a second problem. And then knowing what to do about it is a third problem. But that's the relationship there. And I'm sorry, the other part of the question was?
I think I deleted it. You know what? Your memory. You should check your memory. I can't remember either. So we'll just move on. It's Vox Pop today. It's Medical Monday. I'll search my bin while we go to the phones.
I apologize.
It's my fault, man. Lori in Burnt Hills. Lori, you're on.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
It's not Alzheimer's related, but my husband has been having severe cluster headaches since December of 2024, probably anywhere from 4 to 6 a day, and they originate behind his right eye. And I was wondering if you have any new treatments that you know of.
Okay. Cluster headaches.
Yeah, so cluster headache is a primary headache syndrome. It's different from migraine in that the pain is more intense. It's a maddening pain. A patient with migraine will often go find a dark room to lay down and try and rest. Somebody with cluster headache is up pacing. They're sometimes banging their head against the wall. It's just a really intense pain. And these are usually brief headaches, 20 or 30 minutes in duration, sometimes a little bit longer than that. And they cluster. You may go a long period of time without any headache, and then they start to occur every couple of days, then every day, then several times a day. So it's a tremendous problem for people who are suffering from it. And there are a number of things that can be done to try and break a cluster. Sometimes a short steroid course will bring a cluster to a close. And then there are not as many different preventive options as there are for migraine, but there are a number of good options. Calcium channel blockers are sometimes effective. The CGRP agents, which are a new class of medication over the last 4 or 5 years. Sometimes they're very effective for cluster prevention. I think there have been a couple of reports of botulinum toxin or Botox being helpful for a cluster headache.
Which is something they use for migraines too, right?
Correct. So, yeah, the best thing would be to get your husband in to see a headache specialist, whether that's a neurologist or a primary care doc that sees many, many patients with headache, and talk to them about preventive options because there are some good ones.
Lori, thanks a lot. Did you say steroids is one of the possible remedies?
On the as a short-term treatment, yes. Sometimes if you can break a cluster, if you can stop this repetitive cycle of the cluster headache from occurring by suppressing the inflammatory chemicals that are causing the syndrome, then the cluster ends. So you don't want to use steroids continuously for a long term, because the only list longer than the list of things steroids help is the list of problems they can cause. But for a short course, for 7 to 10 days, sometimes that will break a cluster very quickly and get somebody feeling much better.
So I found Rick's email in my trash bin here, and sense of smell and gum disease. First question was, what percentage of dementia patients show signs of these two biomarkers? And the second was, how exactly does the olfactory bulb play a role? I think you covered all of that, didn't you?
Certainly, I think the second part. The first part, what's the percentage? I'm not sure. I'm not sure anybody knows, because you have to do really good, really population-based, broad-based screening to get reasonable numbers. And I didn't mention gum disease, but there definitely is a link between gum disease and Alzheimer's, and nobody's exactly clear on why that is. But floss and brush keep you out of the hospital.
And to be clear, the teeth plaque have nothing to do with the amyloid
plaques.
Completely
different plaque.
We are joined today by Dr. David Hart. Dr. Hart is a neurologist at the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany. The number here on Medical Monday is 800-348-2551. Brian is in Shelburne Falls. Brian, you're up.
Hey, thank you, Ray. And Ray, thank you for all you do at the station. You're a gem, no doubt.
Thank you, man. Appreciate
it. And Dr. Hart, thank you for your coming on the show today. Dr. Hart, in a group of scientists at McGill University, writing in the journal Nature Medicine in September of 2021, made this statement. And I'm wondering your thoughts on it. While research has long thought brain inflammation was a byproduct of the disease itself, there's a growing hypothesis that it might actually be a driver of the disease progression. That would help explain why researchers have found people whose brains are full of tau tangles and amyloid plaque, but with no outward symptoms of Alzheimer's. And then the general question is, do you think it would be a positive thing to reduce inflammation in the body through our emotional state and eating and exercise and all of that, that would might have a positive effect in lessening the chance of having Alzheimer's or Alzheimer's that's crippling?
Good stuff, Brian. All right, Doc.
Yeah, Brian, I think number one, that there definitely is some evidence that that inflammation helps propagate the problem. There have been retrospective studies where, for example, patients with a disease where they would be on non-steroidals long-term may have a lower rate of Alzheimer's disease than a comparison population. But it has been difficult to show that giving people an anti-inflammatory medication on a prospective basis makes a difference in whether they develop symptoms or not. Maybe we're not doing those studies for long enough. Maybe it takes many years to see that benefit, and that would be a very, very expensive study to do. But it's hard to know for sure. We know that microglial activation— I'm sorry, go ahead, Brian.
Oh, I was just going to say, would the possibility of running endogenous anti-inflammatory hormones like serotonin and the like have a positive effect on that reducing inflammation generally in the body, for sure, but in the brain itself?
Yeah, I would say... I don't know that anybody has specifically proven that, but I would have 100% confidence that that would be the case. I don't know whether that would be through a kind of general effect in kind of the mirror image of anything that that causes more inflammation, that causes more disruption to systems, helps to bring out deficits from a dementia, that settling people down and having them in a less kind of inflammatory repose may well be beneficial for them.
Brian, thanks a lot for the call. Does the presence of inflammation suggest in any way an autoimmune component to some of these dementias?
I guess it does suggest that, but I don't think that there is much evidence that that there's much of a link between Alzheimer's and the autoimmune diseases. Unlike the way, for example, if you have lupus, you're more likely to have rheumatoid arthritis. If you have psoriasis, you're more likely to have, Sjogren's syndrome or something like that.
We're joined today by Dr. David Hart from the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany. The email is voxpop@wamc.org. The phone number is 800-348-2551. Fran writes, if my mother died of complications from Alzheimer's and my dad died from Lewy body, what is the chance I have inherited these genes and will have one or the other in my older years? I'm 72. My mom died in her early 80s. My dad in his 90s.
Well, as we were talking about before, maybe half of 1% of the total number of people with Alzheimer's disease have a single gene that is causative, a single dominant gene that is causative. Those folks almost all present well before age 65. 65 is the cutoff between early onset and late onset dementia, but most of the folks with autosomal dominant Alzheimer's present well before that, in their 30s, their early 40s, sometimes in their 20s. And so if she is in her early 70s, then I'd say she is well past the age of risk for that. We think that late onset Alzheimer's probably is polygenic and maybe is related to having a combination, certain combination of genes along with certain life events, maybe having had a certain number of concussions or having had a certain viral infection or having listened to, too many bad TV shows or Star Trek reruns or something
like
that.
Well, no, hey, you leave Star Trek alone, all right? You don't like the Star Trek.
I didn't say that.
Okay, fair enough. Let's go back to our phones with Dr. David Hart, who's now getting really on the edge here. He's working the very edgy material. He's talking bad about Captain Kirk. Let's go to Dennis in Valencia. Dennis, you're on.
Hello, thank you for this time. I have a question. Well, actually, two questions. Can you highlight a recent success in the VA, something positive, and something that the VA should be working on, please?
Well, I guess one big success is what's called the Million Veterans Program, and this is a program the VA has been running for several years, trying to get at least a million veterans to have DNA sequencing so that the very large population of veterans in this country can create a database for linking genetic abnormalities with disease states. So I think that's a huge success, and I think it'd be very, very hard for that to be done any place other than a place like the VA.
Why?
Because the VA comprises so many centers across 50 states and U.S. territories, so it's an enormous population, and there's enormous power in that kind of a large population.
Okay.
There is pharmacogenomic testing, which is being rolled out through more and more VA centers, and that is testing patients' DNA to see if they are at risk of certain kinds of drug interactions or certain metabolic differences in how they process a medicine to help steer us towards the better medicines for a given individual. So I think those are two big successes for the VA that we can be proud of.
Dennis, thank you very much for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. And we'll get back to the emails in a little bit. Let's go to Hurley and Wendy. Wendy, you're on.
Yes, I was wondering, my father died of Alzheimer's. He was in a kind of a clinical study, so he donated his brain to NYU Brain Center, and he did have Alzheimer's per autopsy. I'm 77, no symptoms of Alzheimer's. Do you think I should have the genetic testing, or would it be advisable?
No, again, I think the genetic testing is pertinent for people who have early onset cognitive difficulties, so people who are developing significant memory and other cognitive changes before age 65. If you're doing well and you're in your 70s, then I don't think the genetic testing is going to be particularly helpful. But I think that doing the preventive things that everybody should be doing can be very helpful, and that would include eating something resembling the Mediterranean diet, trying to get enough sleep, being socially engaged, and most importantly, being physically active, getting 30 minutes a day of what we call sweaty exercise. 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, or an hour, 3 days a week, has tremendous cognitive benefit.
Wendy.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call. It's Medical Monday today, neurology with Dr. David Hart from the VA Medical Center in Albany, the Stratton VA Medical Center. Let's go to Beckett and Walter. Hello, Walter, you're on.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon, gentlemen. A question, this is a great subject about amyloid and tau. I was thinking of the brain barrier that you mentioned, doctor, and it's like a bouncer. And it allows certain drugs to get in or whatever, depending on size. So my question is, can we change to a friendlier bouncer or a brain barrier? Can you modify the brain barrier to enable drugs to get past that bouncer or barrier? Thank you.
Love it.
Yeah, it's. I think it's a really interesting idea, and to some extent that has been tried. But keep in mind that the blood-brain barrier evolved to protect the brain. It is a privileged site. And separated from the rest of the body to minimize the risk of infection crossing over into the brain, to minimize the risk of toxins crossing over into the brain. So you don't want to just, you know, willy-nilly break down the blood-brain barrier. But we were talking about amyloid antibodies, and there was a study published a couple of years ago where they used transcranial ultrasound to temporarily open up the blood-brain barrier. And just after that, within the few hours window of the barrier being more open, they administered an antibody therapy, and they found that when they looked at one side of the brain where this was done versus the other side where it was not, that there was much better penetration of the medicine into the blood-brain barrier-adjusted hemisphere, and also much stronger anti-amyloid effect. So that to do transcranial ultrasound to achieve that is kind of cumbersome and not a great large-scale option, I think, but it does show that if you can, you know, briefly open that window and sneak a medicine in during that time, that that might be one way of getting some benefit.
Walter, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. David Hart is with us today. Let's grab one more before the next break, and then we'll check the email bag, 800-348-2551. If you feel like giving us a call, let's go to Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
Many of these selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors causing tardive dyskinesia.
What is that?
Tardive dyskinesia is an involuntary movement that occurs late after exposure to medication.
Okay.
And it's most well described in response to certain psychiatric medications. Medications like Haldol and Thorazine and the antipsychotic class. And there are probably other medications which can produce it as well. I have not heard of it being linked to SSRIs, but that's not much of an area of focus for me. So I don't mean to say that it hasn't been linked. I'm just not aware of that.
Yeah, thank you.
Jim, thanks for the call. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Dr. David Hart from the Stratton VA Medical Center is here. We'll be back with more of your calls in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Dr. David Hart joins us from Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany. Tell you what, I was going to check the email bag. My phone is not cooperating at the moment. So let's go back and grab some more calls, and then I'll work on the phone while Dr. Hart answers your questions. We'll go to North Adams. Dan, you're on. Well, it's one of those days, I guess. Dan, are you there? Okay. Well, there he was, and I just hung up on him. Dan, call back. Sorry, man. Let's go to David in Great Barrington. David, you're on.
Hey, good afternoon. How are y'all?
Good.
So I just had an inquiry. There was a good friend of mine. She fell off a horse about 17 plus years ago. And ever since, you know, she had pretty significant, you know, she got banged up, hit her head on the ground. And ever since, she has no taste or sense of smell.
Yeah, so that's different than...
And she's been to doctors and of sorts, and she's just basically conceded that that's the way she's going to live the rest of her life. And she's pretty young, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So that is a different mechanism than the neurodegenerative change in the olfactory nerve that happens with Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. I was talking about how the olfactory nerve comes forward from the temporal lobe along the bottom of the skull cavity until it gets just above the nasal, top of the nasopharynx. And then those nerve endings make a 90-degree turn, and they poke through a bunch of tiny holes in this very thin part of the skull to extend into the nasopharynx. When you have a sudden jolt to the head, like falling off a horse or being in a car accident or things like that, the shear force can just rip those nerve endings as they're poking through the bony plate there, the cribriform plate, can just tear those nerve endings off, and they may not regenerate. And that is probably what happened to your friend.
So, yeah, it's unfortunately not repairable.
Oh, so sad.
Yeah, not at this point.
Yeah, like I said, it's over 17 years ago.
And it's very frustrating.
Bad.
And as you mentioned...
We like spicy foods, and she can't taste anything.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and most of your sense of taste is actually from your sense of smell. So it is a real loss of pleasure there for folks who are so affected. It's
David, really sorry for your friend, and thanks for calling. 800-348-2551. All right, Dan in North Adams is going to give it another whack. Let's see. Dan, are you there?
Yeah. Hey, Ray.
Yo.
Do I have you?
You go. You're on.
Hey, Ray.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm here, but Ray's not.
You can't hear us.
How about it, Ray?
Come in here. Okay, go ahead. You're on. Oh, boy.
Hey, Ray, John's, you don't have me, do you?
No, I do. I don't know how you can tell. I'll send up a semaphore or a smoke signal or something. Yes, you're there. Hello. Okay.
Okay, Johns Hopkins looks into cluster headaches, and they use magic mushrooms. So I'd rather have a trip than banging my head against the wall. Thanks, Ray.
Okay, buddy. Thank you. Well, we went through a lot of effort for that one, but it was worth it. 800-348-2551. Monica in New Paltz. Monica, you're on with Dr. David Hart.
Hi. Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Howdy.
Hi. I just have a question of major concern. I'm the youngest of 9 children. My dad died of Parkinson's. A number of years ago, he was in his early 70s, I think 73, 74. And my mom has Alzheimer's, and she will be 98, God bless her, God willing, in April. And I'm just wondering if there's a chance of any of my siblings or myself get it, because so far, none of us have had it, as far as I'm aware. And there are four of us left, but the others have died for other reasons, not related to Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. So I'm just wondering, what's my chance of getting it, or hopefully not?
Reason to be fearful. I tell you what, let's hope Dr. Hart can soothe you a little bit.
Well, I'd say first off.
Yes, thank you.
First off, if there's an autosomal dominant gene in the family causing one of these illnesses, so that means a gene that if you get the gene, you're definitely going to get the illness. If one of your parents had that gene, then you would have about a 50% chance of getting it, because you have a 50% chance of getting that gene. And most of the neurodegenerative disorders are not produced by an autosomal dominant gene. And so your risk, you know, if your mother or father has Alzheimer's, is elevated against the the group of folks who don't have a family history, but it's not as high as 50%. For Parkinson's, until a few years ago, the common wisdom was that it is not a genetic disorder, but it turns out that with more powerful molecular biologic investigation, we found that a lot of people who have Parkinson's really do have a genetic abnormality that's the cause. And so that is information that I think is still developing, and I can't tell you what the risk is, but I think that, you know, the answer is the same, that if you eat right, you treat your brain well, you get enough sleep, you get enough exercise, that that helps to stave off anything in this group.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Monica, thanks for the call. It's 800-348-2551. Dr. David Hart is our guest. Tell you what, folks, if you have emailed, and I see subject headings from several of them, but I can't read them. So if you want to get in right now, I'm going to keep working on it. But if you want to get in right now, try giving us a call at 800-348-2551. Dr. David Hart is here from the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany. And let's go to Vernon, New Jersey. Lynn, you're on.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Sure. Go ahead.
I guess. Yeah. My husband was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And he has since died, but not from that. What I know now is it presented as TDF. And, I mean, his personality changed and his words changed. At any rate, I broke my hip, and he never had a good memory either, so it was hard to tell. I broke my hip, and I had to be in the hospital, but it was during the pandemic, and he couldn't be alone because he would leave the stove on and... So we went to stay with his daughter, and my number was blocked. We had been together, married for 42 years. And he was from 25 to 67, he was my entire adult life. And he ended up, didn't give him his medicine, and didn't tell me that they were getting a hospice, although his doctor did not recommend hospice. His nurse daughter got it. And of course, everything was changed, forged, everything. Huh. So, I mean, and it's not the money, and it really isn't. I, you know, unlike his daughters, I educated myself and I worked and I saved. So my question is there an organization or something that would help me? What I really want is I just want accountability.
Okay.
I mean,
yeah, interesting.
For what they did.
All right, so this is a little off base for Dr. Hart, but go ahead and give it a shot if you want.
Well, obviously, this is a very traumatic experience
yeah.
for you, and so I think working with a grief counselor might be of some help to work through these complicated emotions that you've got after being through this terrible experience. In terms of bringing accountability from the folks who perpetrated this, I'm not the person to answer
yeah.
that question. I'm very sorry.
Sorry, Lynn. Thank you for the call. All right, I have my email working now, so let's get through some of this backlog, and then we'll go back to the phones. If you're on the line, hang in there. Kay writes, are there any treatments to mitigate or prevent neurological complications of long-term Lyme disease? What are some of the potential neurological symptoms of long-term Lyme?
Well, Lyme disease is well known to cause infection of the meninges and much more rarely infection of the brain. Lyme is a spirochete, so it's a similar type of organism to the organism that causes syphilis. Both of these cause a basilar meningitis. They cause an inflammation at the base of the brain, and so they can cause cranial nerve damage. It's well recognized that Lyme is associated with causing Bell's palsy, from inflammation of the facial nerve, the seventh cranial nerve.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are very uncommon cases of localized brain infection with Lyme. And I think there are, you know, a few very specialized centers that are skilled in identifying and treating that. I'm not sure if there are many good strategies other than avoiding tick bites to mitigate the risk of developing something like that.
Anne writes in, I've heard that a certain kind of lithium in small doses has shown to restore memory in mice. I believe that there are clinical trials using lithium now being conducted on people. How optimistic are you, Dr. Hart, that these trials will show the same success as in mice?
Yeah, it was a very interesting report of microdose lithium being used in the brains of mice who were transgenic mice. Mice don't develop Alzheimer's disease, but if you change their genes around, you can make it look kind of like they have Alzheimer's. And so it was found that giving very small doses of lithium changed the brain reaction and improved normalized brain activity near areas of amyloid plaque, I believe. I think it's a long way from large-scale clinical trials. It's an interesting thing to look at, but lithium has been used for migraine prevention. It's been used for bipolar disorder, a number of medical conditions. It's a very challenging medicine to use. It's a medicine that has, at the doses that have been used in those disorders, has a lot of possible side effects to it. So it's very cumbersome, and so I would say I'm not that optimistic about it, but it's worth looking into.
All right, one more email for now, and then we'll try to grab some more before the end of the show. Gail writes in, Lewy body dementia. What's the best way to diagnose it?
Well, there's dementia with Lewy bodies, which is a specific syndrome, and then there's the broader category of Lewy body dementia, which encompasses those folks and also folks who have Parkinson's disease who have developed a dementia down the road. In dementia with Lewy bodies, the Lewy bodies more build up in cortical centers and cause cognitive difficulty, and they cause hallucinations. And so that's how those folks present, usually with very minimal Parkinsonian findings. In Parkinson's disease, the Lewy bodies build up in the brainstem primarily. And so these folks have motor difficulties for a number of years, tremor, rigidity, loss of balance, and so forth. And after many years of that, many of those folks develop a more widespread syndrome of dementia. So the best way of testing for Lewy body dementia is to see a neurologist who is skilled in dealing with dementia, because that's a common group of patients that we see.
All right, let's go back to our phone lines and go to Lynn in Kingston. Lynn, you're on.
Yes. Well, several years ago, I had a stroke. And one of the things they told me was that I had white matter in my brain rather than just gray matter. And what is that?
The brain, there's the cortex of the brain, which is where the cell bodies of the nerve cells reside, and that is the gray matter. The connecting fibers that come from the cell bodies, the axons of the nerves in the brain, have a fatty insulation on them called myelin. And the fiber tracks that connect the different areas of the brain, when you look at the brain, you know, at autopsy, those areas show up white. If you preserve a brain in formaldehyde, then the gray matter turns gray, the white matter turns white, and that's where those names come from. Probably what they told you was when you had the stroke that they found some changes in the white matter of the brain. You had white matter in your brain all along, as we all do. But you may have had a small, deep stroke, and it's pretty common to see white matter changes reflecting that.
Lynn, thank you very much. Now to Saratoga Springs. Jean, you're on.
Hello there. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I wondered, or my brother called me and told me to get off your Lipitor because he heard somewhere that it can cause or is somehow related to getting dementia.
Yeah, this is a persistent question. There had been a study done years ago, I would say maybe in the 5 to 10 years ago range, that found that patients who were on Lipitor had a higher rate of dementia than patients who were not. But it was a methodologically flawed study, and they did not control for vascular risk factors. So a number of studies were done after that where they took large groups of patients and they controlled for what their vascular risk was. And then they looked at those who were on Lipitor or similar medications and those who were not. and they found that there was no increased incidence of dementia. In fact, there was a lower incidence of dementia.
Interesting.
So I think that you know, whether or not to take a given medicine is between a patient and their provider,
yeah.
But I don't think there's a benefit to coming off Lipitor in terms of lowering your dementia risk, and there may be a loss of preventive benefit from doing so.
Right. Makes sense. Okay. Thanks so much. I will stay on it.
Thanks, Gene.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. You know, that's been out there for a long time. And
yes.
Anybody who takes a statin, that goes through the back of their head. Oh,
sure.
Gosh, what do I do? Let's go to Scott in Glens Falls. Scott, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate that. Oops. There
yeah.
I'm wondering, what does it mean when you say death by Alzheimer's itself? That seems kind of like it just seems strange. It seems like there'd be some other sort of indicator.
Okay. I love this. I love this question.
Death as opposed to just Alzheimer's itself.
Can it kill you? Can Alzheimer's itself kill you?
Yes.
Okay. How?
Yeah, Alzheimer's is a neurodegenerative process, tends to start in the memory centers and generalize from there, but it does generalize. And so people start off just having some memory difficulty, but then they develop motor difficulties. They develop sensory difficulties. And as the brain continues to deteriorate, and if you do serial imaging, you can see the brain getting smaller and smaller as the neurons are lost. Eventually, it gets to the point where if nothing else takes somebody before that, the control of breathing and of heart rate and blood pressure may be lost, and people die because of this end-stage neurodegenerative process. It's much more frequent for people to die from a urinary infection or a pneumonia, the sort of things that get debilitated older folks with other problems as well.
All right, Scott, thank you very much. We're almost out of time here. David writes in, are you familiar with the book Doctored, which discusses the manipulation of the data and images from multiple studies of amyloid plaque? Would you care to comment?
I know that there is a fellow whose career basically, or his funding source, is hunting for and finding imaging signs of malfeasance in clinical trials. I don't know how widespread that actually is, and I describe him that way just to say that, he's saying that people are doing something for a profit motive, and you have to, acknowledge that he may have a profit motive in popularizing his beliefs here. I don't think there's any question that amyloid is tightly linked to what happens in Alzheimer's. I don't think there's any question that, the amyloid treatments that are out there now and on the market do make a significant difference for patients. They're not the end-stage treatments that we need, but I think we're on the right track and moving forward with that.
All right, Dr. David Hart, we are out of time, sir. Thank you for being with us. Thanks for making these semi-annual appearances on the show, and I guess we'll see you, summertime?
All right. It's always fun, Ray. Thanks for asking me back.
Support comes from Woodland Pond at New Paltz, a life plan community at the foot of the Schwangunks near education, the arts, and outdoor activities. Future residency waitlist available, woodlandpondnp.org. Thanks again to Dr. David Hart of the Stratton VA Medical Center for being here today. Thank you for listening. Tremendous calls today. A lot of emails. I got to about a third of them, and I apologize. We'll do better next time, and Dr. Hart will be back again in about 6 months or so. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Jim Mountier screened the calls. Thank you, Jim. All right. So here's the deal. Tomorrow at 2, Gordon Fricke will be with us to talk about car maintenance and repair. The thing is, Governor Hochul is giving her State of the State at 1 p.m. If she runs late, we might be a little late, but we plan to see you at 2. We'll